overview of Windows 10 for education, everyone. My name's Macca. If you can't handle Macca, it's Andrew. But most people know me as Macca. I'm an account technology strategist looking after the education space in Victoria and WA. And I have with me Callum McLennan from TIBA, one of our partners in Victoria. And today we are going to be talking to you about what Windows 10 offers us for education. And one of the things that is clear to everyone, most likely in this room, is that education is one of those things that is continually morphing and continually changing. So we're always thinking about the way our learning styles are playing out, the way that we can potentially augment those learning styles with better types of technology, and how technology can make the entire learning experience easier and more efficient. With Windows 10, there's a lot of new functionality in this particular version of the operating system that really helps to enable this new world of learning. And yes, I will get through the marketing slides fairly quickly, but I'm sounding very, very honest and type of marketing type of person at you, so I'm sure that you're really taking this in and enjoying it. We're enabling a new world of learning with Windows 10, and really what we see is these sort of five major areas in which we're trying to change the game in education when it comes to Windows 10. In terms of flipped classrooms, the idea that more and more often now we're starting to see, rather than having that one screen projecting to everyone in the room, we're getting a lot more interaction in education with multiple screens across multiple rooms and really getting an idea of a single experience per user. Project-based learning is becoming really important when it comes to education systems. Having multiple classes, multiple groups in multiple classes, being able to collaborate together in centralised areas such as OneNote or such as SharePoint Online. If we look at differentiated learning, the ability for us to provide a different way of learning. In earlier years or in previous years, the idea of Mathletics, the idea of Storybird, the idea of Study Ladder as an integral part of the curriculum on a day-to-day basis for, let's say, the K-12 environment was not necessarily something that we would be expecting to happen. But more and more often these days, we're turning to those technologies, turning to cloud-based technologies or even on-premises-based technologies to allow us to more fully immerse ourselves in that education world. So what we've tried to do with Windows 10 is build the education platform for 21st century learning, and we've done that across four major pillars. The first one is around better learning outcomes. And how do we get better learning outcomes? We get that by fundamentally making the operating system easier to deal with. And unfortunately, when it came to that last version of the operating system, the one we shall not name, we changed the game a little bit and thought, you know what, everyone uses tablets now, so what we'll do is we'll concentrate on the tablet interface and everyone will love us. And it worked out really well, didn't it? We said, oh, no, we'll do. We'll bring out start screen. Everyone will love that start screen. And the start screen, of course, made the entire world fall in, and everyone hated the start screen. So one of the things we really needed to do is say, right, let's get the thing to a point where it's fantastic for a tablet user and it's fantastic for a mouse and keyboard user. And let's start bringing back a lot of the things that we're familiar with to make it easier to work with at the end of the day. Second thing that we've really looked at here is in terms of affordable devices and solutions. So the idea is that it's a single operating system that should work the same way across a multitude of different types of devices. You shouldn't be locked into a certain way of interacting with that particular machine that you're dealing with. If it's a tablet machine, it should look and feel the same way a desktop machine should look, and if it's a mobile device type machine, it should look and feel the same. Whether it's the smallest style IoT device up to the biggest Surface Hub, it's one style of operating system to rule them all and to run them all. The next thing is safety and security. Do we worry about safety and security in our environment? Of course we do, and Windows 10 is very much a security release. Lots of new features in the operating system to make your everyday lives a lot more secure. Get away from passwords, start thinking about more biometric ways of authenticating to the environment, ensuring that we're not losing credentials, that we are who we say we are, and that we're protecting the machines from other types of attacks down the track. And we don't just do that in the operating system itself, but around the operating system with some of those other capabilities that we offer in things such as the Enterprise Mobility Suite. We're really all about safety and security now, and we'll talk about that a bit more later on. And then finally, deployment and management. Who loves doing a Big Bang deployment? My God. Okay, so we do have a couple of strange people in the room, but that's okay. If you're into those Big Bang deployments, no worries. But you know what do we usually do when we're deploying that operating system? We go through that horrible cycle of saying, right, let's do the application compatibility testing. And that we think we're going to take around about 8 weeks on that. But in actual fact, it takes us about 5-6 months. Right, and we get through that, and then we're going to build the image, fantastic. And then we think, oh God, how many bloody makes and models of machines have we got here? How am I doing with drivers? I'm going to get all those drivers that I need, and I'm going to whack everything in a config manager, and we're just going to go PMP scan and just pull all the drivers we need until the PMP scan ID matches to two different drivers, and then the wrong one ends up on your machine, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you know what I'm talking about, don't you, because you've been there before. I've got a network adapter. The network adapter starts with, actually, we better not say that, a certain product name, and we know that that Wi-Fi adapter is going to be a bugger when it comes to the drivers. You know, we've been there and done that. We want to do this again once more for Windows 10, and then we want to make it easier to manage and easier to deploy from that point onwards. So for those students that are bringing in bring your own device style devices, we want to provide just the amount of management we need for those through potentially a cloud service such as Microsoft Intune. And for those devices that we own, we want that complete control for them with products such as Configuration Manager or MDT as a way of pushing that out. But what happens if we just need to provision a machine to get itself to a point where it can get in our network, get configured, get compliant, and then get going? In other words, someone goes to Harvey Norman, buys a machine, brings it in. I want to be able to just quickly get it up and running. We have provisioning packages for that as well. So we've done a whole lot of stuff in the operating system to make this a hell of a lot easier. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through for the rest of these 60-odd minutes or so before we open up for questions, just what it is that we've done for you in Windows 10. But at the end of the day, if you leave with nothing else, I want you to remember this sort of simple slogan. It's one experience, one platform, and one store to rule everything across every form factor. Whether you're dealing with a Surface Hub or a HoloLens or an Xbox or any of the myriad types of form factors from mobile device slash phone up to the two-in-one machine, it's all running that basic Windows 10 operating system, which means fundamentally, we have that one set of tasks and that one set of skills that we need to learn to look after that particular platform. So let's have a look at better learning outcomes. So what types of stuff have we done in the operating system to make it easier to work with on a day-to-day basis? First thing we need to think about is this becomes a platform that you never outgrow. We needed this to be easy, because we made a few mistakes in Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 in terms of how we thought people would work with their devices, and we introduced a very much touch-friendly interface that didn't necessarily go down well with our users. Now, who had trouble with students and teachers with that start interface? Hands up. It got better over time, maybe, but fundamentally, probably a lot of you went out there and got, you know, apps from the Windows Store to bring back that start interface or something like that, because people were used to using things the way they'd always done it from Windows XP onwards. We had the nice little start button, we had the search area, all of our recently used stuff popped up, it was nice, it was easy, fantastic. So we brought that back straight away. So the Windows start experience is back. Everything that you liked about it from Windows XP through Windows 7, I'm pretty sure I don't even need to mention Windows Vista because probably no one remembers what that is. Windows 7 and onwards, it's back now. So all your recently used files are there. Your search is directly in front of you. But what we've done is we've taken what worked with the start screen, such as tiled interfaces and live tiles in those interfaces, being able to consume data coming down the internet pipe to give you an understanding of what's going on, to update those tiles automatically with information you need to know about, whether it be weather information, news information, whatever. And we've left that in the start menu. So that stuff that you liked and you thought was reasonably good is still there, but we have all of that old functionality that still works. So that's really important to us. Additionally, we needed to make sure that because this is a single platform that works across everything the same way, that it would be one experience and one platform, whether it be a lab environment, whether it be the laptop cart that you're wheeling between classrooms, whether it be a student's individual machine, whether it be a teacher's individual machine or an administrator's workstation. Everything needed to look and feel the same and ensure that we were managing it in the same way. So what we want to do now is just give you a bit of an idea of what we've done in terms of the changes to the user experience. So just a few little things that are different, give you an idea of what Windows 10 is like. And before we get into this, just a quick show of hands, who actually runs Windows 10 on their daily machine today? Cool. So a lot of what you're going to see, you've probably already done. But if you don't run Windows 10 today, and this is still a reasonably new operating system to you, then hopefully some of the new things that you see here we'll show you what it's like to work with on a day-to-day basis. So with that, I'm going to hit what I think is number 6 and hand it over to Cal.
Alrighty. So we're going to start with basic user experience. Yep, we're all good. Yep. And you see, we're gone back to a more of a traditional kind of desktop layout. You've got your start menu, none of this opening up on the big app screen anymore. Come in here, we've got, you know, nice looking start menu. Still got your Windows 8 apps kind of layout. So if you want.
One of the things that's really interesting here that I'd like to point out, Cal, if you don't mind, is what we're running here, and you'll notice, is a specific SKU for Windows 10, which no one in the room has any hope of reading, called Windows 10 Education. And we'll talk more about Windows 10 Education a little bit later. But one of the cool things about Windows 10 Education is when you install it out of the box, the new update that's just come out, you'll actually get that pre-created with some learning apps already, such as Khan Academy.
So going back to the start menu, now we can change it around. So see, I've got mine a little bit bigger. If we want to make that smaller, we can scale it right down, scroll through it, you know, so it doesn't take up your whole screen. Or if you want that Windows 8 experience where it's basically the entire screen, there you go. If you've got a lot of apps, a lot of education apps, all your office apps, you know, you can get everything in there. Media students a lot use a lot of Adobe products. Yeah. Personally, I use about 8 different ones, so that's really good. You know, you can have everything there. You don't have to go scrolling through heaps of different directories looking for different programs. Really good for students.
The one thing I am confused about, though, is given that we have this education SKU, why we bothered to pre-populate it with Candy Crush Soda? Because surely that's not going to help us in our classroom. But anyway, never mind.
Okay, moving on. So now we're going to look at the new PC Action Center. So you can see it's replaced the traditional Windows 8 charms. You don't have those traditional 4 buttons anymore. You've got a full Action Center. Really nice. You know, VPN, if you don't want to do that. Can set all your settings, nice.
So basically what you're saying is that we've got that one place now that we can use to pretty much get anywhere we want.
Exactly right, and multiple ways to access it. If you're using the touch interface, traditional way to access this charms menu, swipe to the right, there we go.
Because everyone loved the charms menu, right? Because that was really clear what you had to do with it in Windows 8, wasn't it?
And as you can see there in the top left row, we've got tablet mode, change that, you know, save you know, ripping it off and it's not working like Surfaces might do.
Speaking of which, why don't you rip that off and show everyone what can happen there?
Well, all right. Fingers crossed. Hey, there we go. So I've got mine set to always ask at the moment. So we can change that here, you know, remember my response, but just I'll leave it as always ask. I'll wait for it to kick over. And it didn't work. So what we do, hit tablet mode. And here we go, tablet mode. Open up Paint. And move things around. I've got all my open applications. Get traditional tablet mode.
And what I like about that, what I really like about that is the fact that we now have that sort of smart snap capability. So you'll notice that when he moved the window over to the right-hand side there, it immediately brought up in the other area all of the applications that were still open, making it really easy for me to snap the application that I need side by side by the currently active application. So I think that's a really good effort. Notice here too, which Cal was probably going to mention in a moment, that we've gone from a start menu to a start screen because Cal's turned it into a tablet all of a sudden. So we've realised, hey, hang on a minute, this person is no longer treating this like a traditional mouse and keyboard. What we've actually done is we're now working like a tablet. And so we've moved to that start screen straight away. And if we put that back, we'll flip back to a normal mode and we'll be back with the start menu.
Okay. So now we're in tablet mode. We'll open up some applications. Another one. We go to the task view. You can see I've got my 4 applications there. I've got it like that. One Paint. Cool. Drag it down. And Paint is now closed. So we go back to the task view. You can see I've only got those 3 applications. Really nice, really responsive. Touch screen, you know, great if you're for the kids. They can just swipe down rather than look for those little nuisance of X arrows. Hmm. It's so we can go back to task view, see the three open applications, scroll to right, go back to my start menu. Lovely. You can also swipe to the right. Okay, fingers are pretty calloused. And we go back to task view. So multiple ways to enter the task view, which is a great new feature. You can see your multiple windows, open up some more things. Minecraft.
And this is probably one of those things that you don't really want on that main start menu. Minecraft for Windows 10. I'm sure that pretty much every kid, given an opportunity, is going to start playing around with that. Well, what we're really trying to show you here is that there is a whole lot of different ways in which you would work with it to do the same stuff that you've already always done. So you're not locked into one way of working with the operating system. You don't have to use a mouse and keyboard. You don't have to use a touch environment.
Close that one down again. And we're back to the start menu. Nice and easy, nice and simple, works well.
Cool. All right, now. So moving on from that, one of the things we try to do with the OS is make sure that we have made this as relevant as possible for the average education audience. And what we've really tried to do, especially in terms of the tablet product line, is make this as easy to work with as possible for an inking style environment. Because traditionally speaking, working with a pen rather than a mouse and keyboard has quite a lot of benefits when it comes to actual learning capability and processing of information. So if I'm interacting with a PDF file or a Word document, and I can start highlighting that, marking that up, and making annotations with a pen or with my finger, that's generally considered to be more effective than when I'm just using a mouse and keyboard. Now, because of this, we've done a lot of work in the generic ability for a student to be able to do their research. And if we look at what we've done with Microsoft Edge, being the new version of the browser, we've tried to make this as an immersive experience as possible. We've built Microsoft Edge for the modern web. The idea is that a student is going to, generally speaking, a web page to use that for research purposes. And that web page shouldn't really be just a static environment that the user copies and pastes from and tries to gather their thoughts around a standard notepad or a Word file. So what we want to be able to do is treat that entire web environment as though it was an editable canvas, or a canvas that can at least be shared with other people that might be in a collaborative team when we're dealing with a group project. So one of the things that we can do with Microsoft Edge is go into what we call annotation mode. So from a single web page, I can change my inputs from mouse and keyboard to a highlighter style scenario, or interact directly with a pen in that particular website, annotate it directly, crop information from the website, move it into OneNote, move it into whatever other environment I need to, and even share aspects of a web page that have been marked up with other members of my team, whether it be through an automatic send to a SharePoint site, whether it be cropping and sending via email or anything like that. Edge is a lot more responsive as a browser than previous versions of Internet Explorer, so we believe that this is one of those environments you're going to really enjoy working with. And when Windows 10 first came out a few months ago, you know, Edge still had a few problems with certain web pages. And we've seen real improvements with Edge's compatibility across web pages in general since then. And it's really becoming very much a web browser that you can depend on. So what we'll do now is we'll get Cal to show us a little bit about Microsoft Edge before we start talking a bit about Internet Explorer.
Alrighty. So we're just going to focus on the tablet mode of Edge at the moment. So we're going to open up Edge. Okay, reloaded. Go to my pre-saved favorites. It's good old TechNet, just for a bit of an example. And we'll wait for the internet to load.
You kind of hope that TechNet's available. Because without TechNet, it's going to be pretty hard to show. There's the demo. There we go. Fantastic.
Okay. So I'm going to start. We'll go look through the OneNote integration with Edge. You can see here that little square of the box. I've got OneNote integration open. So we'll start with a little bit of a ink sort of tool, as they will call it. So I've got that. And hey, I can write on the page. Pretty cool. Okay, say if I'm more of a doing a bit of more of a study kind of session, you know, I'm cramming for an exam, stuff like that. I've got a highlight mode. So I'll just remove that one because that was a bit of a...
And notice too that when you actually annotate, when you're annotating in this highlighter style scenario, if you annotate in a way that you're not happy with, Callum just showed you that you could go into that eraser and just remove aspects of what it is that you've done that's incorrect. So it makes it very easy to not only annotate web pages, but also to remove that annotation when it's not needed.
Yeah, exactly right. So to show the highlight thing, I'll just zoom in a bit. Okay.
Yeah, I'll hold questions to the end if that's all right.
See there, I say server and management, I want that one. Okay. There, give it a bit of a highlight. Lovely. So when I'm looking through later, server management, it's going to pick, it's going to stand out, boom, highlighted. Now go back to show the eraser tool again. I'm going to get rid of this scribble here. Okay, maybe I don't want to look at server management anymore. It's gone. And the final little tool called notes. You can add notes in. I'll just get my keyboard up. I'm going to say study.
So this is really useful because what it allows us to do is start, you know, annotating exactly in the web page where the note is relevant to, rather than us necessarily having to refer to a different document somewhere else or potentially put a link into a OneNote file and then annotate under that when we're not actually sure where in the page we were referring to in the first place.
See, I've minimized that, but the little icon's still there. That's number one note. Can open up again. Boom, there's my notes. So I want another one. Go back to notes. Put it up here. It's labeled as number two, so it's all organized. You can keep track. If you're really organized, you can keep a key of all your notes and you can tell, go back later. Okay, one is for server, two is for Windows, three is for data. So say I'll go back, type a note here. So study. Okay, maybe I don't want that. Delete, and it's gone.
Nice.
So the final little tool is the snipping tool. Say if I'm doing a project, I need a picture from Microsoft or a just a big lot of information I don't want to have to type up.
We've got a particularly unattractive person here by the name of Jeff Alexander. Maybe we can get him.
Okay, so...
Don't tell him I said that.
That.
You're a beautiful man, Oren. Well done. He's got one supporter in the audience. That's good.
Copy. And now that is saved to the clipboard.
We can go and paste that directly into OneNote if we want.
Yep. And to save all that, we go save.
What you'd normally do is you'd go into OneNote and paste it out. I think OneNote is not open at the moment, so...
No, we'll go into here and we say we want to save to OneNote. Hit save, your note was saved.
So now it's in OneNote.
View note. Keyboard pops back up because we're in tablet mode. And here we can see...
So basically, you can see there that it's brought it straight into OneNote for you. I reckon we stick that keyboard back on.
Yeah.
Cool.
OneNote. That's it for Edge.
All right, now the thing is that not everyone is going to be ready to go to Edge straight away. Now, who's got web applications that they've actually developed for older versions of Internet Explorer? Okay. So one of the things that we need to be very aware of is we're not chucking Internet Explorer away. So Internet Explorer in its traditional style, being Internet Explorer 11, ships with Windows 10 as well. So basically what this means is if you've got older applications that you need to run in that full version of Internet Explorer, you're still good to go. But what happens if we've gone and got ourselves a web application that was maybe developed for IE 8, IE 9, IE 10? There's something that we all need to be aware of. In January 16 next year, the only supported version of Internet Explorer from Microsoft is going to be Internet Explorer 11. So we need to start thinking about how we're going to be getting our web apps across from those earlier versions of IE and rendering properly on IE 11. Now, we have a product out there called Internet Explorer, Enterprise Mode Internet Explorer, or EMIE. And Enterprise Mode Internet Explorer is something that's been around since Windows 8.1. Basically, what it allows us to do is it allows us to put Internet Explorer into a mode and understand how to render web pages correctly and how to position web pages correctly that have been developed for earlier versions of Internet Explorer. And we can set this up centrally through group policy, and then provide the list of URLs to our Internet Explorer client centrally that are known to be bad with Internet Explorer 11 via group policy as well. We can even use a tool that is free from Microsoft to allow us to inventory all of the different URLs that our users are going to and pick the ones that we can see are not rendering properly in Internet Explorer 11 and use that as the basis for populating that list of URLs that Internet Explorer 11 will use and automatically render in a down-level version of IE when it sees it. So what does that mean effectively in one sentence? It means that with Enterprise Mode IE, you can make any application running from IE 8 all the way through to 11 work properly in Windows in IE 11. So effectively, you can move to IE 11 knowing full well that your applications are going to work. And then what you can do is start thinking about how we're going to refactor those apps to work natively in IE 11 a little bit further down the track. Because there might be a scenario where you've got an older style web application and you're in the process of effectively redeveloping it, but it's not going to be ready until July, August next year. So with Enterprise Mode IE, you've bought yourself that time that you need to get the browser upgraded and then do the repaving of the application later on down the track. What we couldn't do was give you Edge and remove Internet Explorer, because that would have made us even more popular than we already are. So that's still in there, you don't have to worry. So when it comes to devices and solutions, what do we have for you? We believe that Windows, on whatever device form factor you choose, is the best device for education. And the reason we say this is because the multitude of devices that are out there will allow us to use a copy of Windows for any learning style whatsoever, whether it's touch-based, whether it's mouse and keyboard-based, whatever. We've got a device that can handle it, whether it's a first-party device through Microsoft and the Surface range, or whether it's an OEM device from a third party. And that also leans to each budget as well. So I'm sure that we've probably all seen scenarios where we're looking at what types of devices we want to buy, and for lesser workloads and needs, we'll go for a much cheaper machine that might not be as powerful. But for those bigger needs, such as CAD-type environments or potentially music-style environments, we might go for a more expensive but more capable device as well. And of course, the other thing we've got to think about is how you're deploying these things. So we need to make sure that the deployment mechanism is going to be valid, whether we're dealing with a ruggedized tablet or a full-blown desktop PC or a Surface Hub or whatever the case may be. And with Windows 10, we satisfy that as well. And when you think about the types of devices that you generally see, again, we can provide you a Windows 10 device for any of those stages of education that you might be dealing with. So in a primary school environment, when you're dealing with very small children, you quite often see the main way of interacting with the machine being a touch-based environment. So you'll see a lot of tablets out there in schools. And that makes a lot of sense when you're a lot younger and you're still developing a lot of the motor skills that you need. And then when we get into middle school, we'll start seeing more advanced capabilities through high school and then into university, where we're likely to see all sorts of stuff from the IoT board all the way up to the Surface Hub. Hopefully too, you'll be looking at the HoloLens session a little bit later this week. I'm not quite sure what day that is or what time that is, but get across to the HoloLens session and think about the types of things that this can potentially do for an education environment and how that can be moving forward. I would actually be a little bit scared though if one day I was standing up in front of an entire classroom of people wearing these things staring at me. It'd be kind of like the Cylons had finally arrived and we were in all sorts of bother, but never mind. It could happen one day. What we also believe is that Windows 10 makes existing devices better. Now, what do I mean by that? At the end of the day, the hardware requirements for Windows 10 remain unchanged from Windows 8, and remain predominantly unchanged from Windows 7 as well. So the benefit here is for those of you that have got an older fleet, let's say you've got machines that are 3 years old and later, you'll still be able to take those machines from Windows 7, Windows 8, through to Windows 10. And in the majority of cases, you'll get a better experience from what you were currently running. Pretty much with every operating system we bring out, we try and improve the resources that are needed to run the base OS. So what you'll notice with Windows 10 is it has a lighter memory footprint than Windows 7 did, and you'll generally speaking see that it is more performant on a machine that was designed for Windows 7 than Windows 7 is. So you should not have any real need to decide you need to go out and basically refresh the entire fleet when you're bringing in Windows 7, because it can handle those older devices. And don't forget that there's new device innovations coming at all times, and that's what we've tried to do with Windows 10 to ensure that we function just as effectively with a pen input, just as effectively with a touch input, just as effectively in a two-in-one environment, and that seamless transition between that tablet mode and that more traditional mouse and keyboard mode, as Callum showed before, when he removed the type cover from the Surface. Of course, when it comes to revolutionary devices, this is the first version of Windows that's been designed to run on an IoT device, like a Raspberry Pi. We have now a version of Windows 10 called Windows 10 Core, which we can load onto an IoT board and then start working directly with that. The HoloLens is a revolutionary new device, and don't forget the Surface Hub as well. So for those of you that are keen on, you know, really getting those really large-style learning devices in place, then the Surface Hub is potentially an option for you. And thinking about Surface Hub and the collaboration capabilities with that, when you're dealing with large-scale group projects, if you have various rooms on various campuses that have Surface Hubs, it's a real cinch to be able to join collaborative environments, shared whiteboard, et cetera, with those. The other thing we've done in Windows 10 is produce this new type of app called the Universal App. And the Universal App is designed to be developed once to run on any style of Windows 10 machine. What we had in the past was a pretty much fragmented store type model, where you would build an app to run on a phone, and then you build the app again to run on Windows 8 through the Windows 8 store. And that's just not practical for the average developer. If we're trying to encourage developers to put stuff in our store to potentially get out there to your schools because they want to make money out of it, if we're making them develop twice for two different styles of environments, they're just not going to do it. And it's far, far easier to develop for something like iOS or Android that uses that single unified store to get to everything. So with Windows 10, we now have universal apps. Essentially, an app is developed once. It will run the same way on a Windows phone device as it will on a desktop device as it will on a tablet device. And we come now to a single converged store, Windows Store environment, where we can get all of that information, where we can pull those applications down. We'll talk more about the store in a moment, but we've done quite a few things in the store space to make it much easier for you to start procuring applications for your environment as well and getting them out there, because the store has frequently been an area of difficulty for people. Who has dealt with, or who's had to deal with, the way in which you buy something from the Windows Store and found that to be not so great for an education environment? Cool. We've got some good news. You've probably heard about it already, but things are really kicking along there now. But before we talk about that, what I want to do is just get Callum to show you a brief look at the Universal Office apps that are available now. So recently what we did is we released Word, Excel, PowerPoint as universal apps in the Windows 10 Store that are really designed for that touch style environment as well. So I'll hand it over to you, Callum, to show us a little bit about those new applications.
Alrighty. So we're going to start with Universal App Excel. So these are touch integrated, very, very responsive. I was using them for the last couple of days and I'm very impressed. As someone who uses Excel, 4 out of 8 hours of the day, I'm on it all the time.
You must love your job, mate.
It frustrates the shit out of me. If I had this 6 months ago, I would have been a lot happier. But let's have a look through this new touch integrated Excel. As you can see here, I've got a data sheet for a camera company. So you can see standard data sheet, your salary, all the information you could possibly want for a camera. See here, I'm just going to go through this. I'm not going to use the mouse at all. I'm going to put it over there and touch. I can select. I can go, hey, I want that entire row. Lovely. All without using a mouse. Yep. That makes Excel a lot more fun to me. I don't know about anyone else, but makes it a lot easier on anyone that uses this program a lot. So if we go over to this tab, this week, so we'll go, I'm going to make a table. So we'll select that one cell, okay. Insert, and go table. Oh, okay, we've got one there. So you can see here, that's one table. Now with this, you don't actually have to select every cell you want as a table. You can just select the one, you go table, and it's going to go ahead and do it for you. Excellent feature. So now let's say if I want a chart, I'm going to select my table, go recommended, chart title. Hey, I've got a chart. Lovely.
Nice.
Let's see, It's also very, very nice looking, this XL. It's very easy in the eyes, really high def.
Well, we'll look even better when you stretch out that bottom row, which would be really nice.
It's
What I like about this too is it's really immersive. Interesting that we've chosen to show you the three books down the bottom there, but never mind. It's still very immersive indeed.
Now, one more thing we can do with this is we no longer have to go through. It's all touch integrated, so if I want that column smaller, just drag it across. Lovely.
I mean, this is stuff we've been able to do in Excel forever, right? But the idea is that we shouldn't be locked into a certain way of actually playing with this particular application. If I want to interact with it with my hands, that should be as easy for me as though I was interacting with it with a keyboard and mouse. And because we have these new features and the ability for us to automatically move between desktop and tablet mode when I start playing around with a two-in-one or with a tablet detachable keyboard, then it should be seamless for me to be able to go between those environments as I'm working.
Okay, so now we're going to look at MS Word Universal App. So we've got our lovely document on photography.
Beautiful.
And cameras. So I'm going to put it into reading mode firstly. You can see here we've got a nice dual page setup. So you can just flip through it. Nice and easy, very responsive. Appropriate load time for pages. It's not one flick and you're at the end of the document. Which is not very useful if you've got a 600-page document and you need to get to page 250.
The other thing I like here too is that you're not having to learn anything new. You know, reading mode is familiar to you with a full version of Office 2016 or 2013, and it's still in the universal app mode as well. And the great thing about this too is if you have a a standard Office 365 subscription or whatever the case may be, then you simply authenticate using your A365 tenant credentials, and that opens up the full features and capabilities of the app for you.
Okay. So our next feature, we can see here that little red text bubble up the top there. You open that up. We've got comments. So it's really useful if you've got a document getting passed around the office or school report. You've got a, say, a class with multiple teachers, student teachers, they can all add their comments in.
The other thing I'd note there too is when you're in this mode, because it is designed for touch, we're making sure that we're keeping enough space between the actions for the average human finger. So we're not squashing things up like we would do if we were in a mouse and keyboard input where we've got very finite control of that arrow when we don't need to, you know, maintain that real estate between those different commands and different capabilities.
Yep. So you can see here we've got the comments. So in the ISO range is off the chart below. Can we verify the research? Okay, so I'll follow up with the team. Say I'm part of the team. Hit reply. Okay, excellent. Thanks.
Beautiful.
Hit enter. Lovely. Now, my comments in there, save it, pass it on. Less of a paper trail, less of an email trail, less of the, hey, did you get the document? It's all in there.
And if we were thinking about this in a, you know, a standard sort of collaborative project style environment, we might be saving that back to a SharePoint Online team site as part of Office 365, and that's then being not only saved back in a an online service, but we could, through our OneDrive Sync client, be able to then keep a copy of that locally as well, just as if it was part of the basic file system.
Okay. So the final feature we're going to look at for Word. So we've got this document, we've got depth of field. Okay, maybe I want to know a bit more about that. So I'm going to highlight that, right click. We've got this thing here called Smart Lookup. So that's just going to go poll Bing. It's going to bring a whole bunch of results right back into Word. So there's no alt-tabbing, there's no mucking around. It's all in that one interface. Lovely.
And that is lovely for school environments. So if we're working in a collaborative environment or even on our own, and a child is trying to do some research and is maybe not quite sure of what a particular phrase means or what a particular word means, it's just a matter of highlighting that and hitting the Smart Lookup button to get more information directly from the web. And that in turn can lead to further information that they need, which through the Edge browser they could then grab, annotate, do whatever they need to. So it all kind of fills in together.
And we can also, while we're in there, as you can see, we've got that highlight feature again, similar to Edge, but it's a lot neater. Because it'll do it for you. Again, save that. So we're going to go back into edit mode. You can see we've got that portrait
view, style interface.
Portrait view back up. So I'm going to scroll through, nice and smooth, nice and quick.
Cool.
So another feature we're going to look at is the search feature in Word. Say we've got a student that doesn't know what they want to say, a header and a footer. Confused me when I first heard of it, and probably still does to this day. So, header. See, and now we've got no results.
So basic find functionality is still involved in
there
here
we
as
go.
Well.
Wrong search feature. So header.
Beautiful.
So we've got remove header, edit header. We've got all the possible things you want to do with a header and a footer. All in that one thing, so you don't have students going, oh, where's header and footer? Oh, it's under file, it's under properties, under file, under 1,000 different directories. So type it in, comes up, beautiful.
And the other thing we need to remember here too is that, you know, occasionally, depending on where we are, whether we're dealing with a university or whether we're dealing with a high school environment, we quite often, as IT people, make the assumption that people know how to do things like headers and footers. So by being able to go into that help environment and just type what it is I'm trying to do and then get contextual-based help on how to do that, that makes a lot of students' lives a hell of a lot easier so that we're not spending a lot of time wasted teaching them how to do basic stuff.
Alrighty, and finally we're going to look at universal version of PowerPoint.
Everybody's favourite tool, Microsoft's favourite tool.
Okay, so we're going to kick this slideshow off. Lovely camera slideshow again, keeping with the theme. I'm going to touch that, hit my next. See? Lovely animations.
All those standard animations that are available in the versions of Office that we're used to, still available there as well.
And very high quality, which can come in handy depending on the presentation you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Media students, pretty much essential to have as high as quality as you possibly can get, especially once you climb up into the education range. So let's go through.
And notice too that because we have that touch integration, that we can either use the keyboard or we can swipe back and forth to move the slideshow around. Cool.
Standard, I won't go through the entire PowerPoint.
All right. Okay, so hopefully that gives you an idea that those applications, which will work the same way on the phone, the same way on the tablet-style interface, are just as full-featured as you would normally get in a full-blown MSI version. Now, the one thing we really need to think about is how the Windows Store works. What we've tried to do is make sure that the Windows Store is as ready for education as it can be. So you may have heard of the Windows Store for Business, and I really think that it would be a good idea for you to go and check out Michael Niehaus's sessions a little bit later on in the week, because he'll be talking a little bit more about the Windows Store for Business as well. But one of the real challenges in education is how we actually think about getting the apps that we want, that we traditionally buy from an App Store style interface, onto the student machines and make it easy for those to be procured, tracked, and then licenses reclaimed when they're no longer used. Now, in the current version of the Windows Store, and if you look at things like the App Store and Google Play, that's quite difficult because of the way the payment methods work. If we look at the Windows Store today, what we need to do is we need to log in with a Microsoft account, we need to apply a credit card to it, and when it comes to decking out an entire classroom with copies of this application, it's not really something that we can expect parents to deal with in a school style situation where we're asking them to procure the apps with a credit card and then bring them down to the machine. So what we're going to be able to do, and we can do that right now, if you go to the Windows Store for Business, you can sign up right now with your Azure Active Directory credentials, is provide you a carved off version of the Windows Store that is specifically locked down to your Azure Active Directory tenant. And what this will allow us to do is set up volume licensing and flexible payments for the different styles of app that we want. So what we can now do with the Windows Store for Business is say, I need to do a site licensed copy of, let's say, an Adobe product that's coming through that Windows Store. So what I'll do is I'll set that up, I will determine the payment method, being in this case a purchase order, and we'll give you the ability to do things like buy with purchase order, buy with corporate card, or buy as a site licensed style of purchase construct. And then what we'll do is we'll track which of those machines have had this application installed on them. So what the student will do is log in with their O365 credentials or their Azure Active Directory credentials. They'll go to the store. They'll see the apps that are available to them that have been procured for them from that particular learning institution. Then they'll just download and install that. On the back end, you'll be able to see how many licenses have been consumed. And if you've got yourself to a point where you don't have any more licenses available, then we'll stop those apps from being procured down to the machines the next time the student goes into your particular version of the store. You can be alerted when you've got more no more licenses left. You can reclaim those licenses if you know that we have certain users that are no longer in your environment anymore. And if you're dealing with things like Microsoft Intune as a way of using mobile device management to lightly touch and manage your machines, you can also handle the removal of those applications through the wipe process that's available there. So this is definitely something you might want to look at a little further in the week in some of the later sessions. So just to sort of try and give you an idea of how that works today. So right now today we have the Windows Store, which in its traditional sense remains the same. So if you log in with a Microsoft account, you purchase through credit card, et cetera, et cetera. We also have the custom app store available to us for those of us that are running Microsoft Intune, giving us a single company portal style interface to go and get what we need. And then as we move into that more business store oriented way of doing things, then we'll generally speaking be able to provide you with the best of both worlds there. So log in once to the store, identify yourself as part of the educational institution, see the apps that are available to you straight away. When it comes to deploying apps, we're basically going to give you as many options as you want. And this is another thing that we've really tried to make sure we've been careful with in Windows 10. We don't want to force you into one way of doing anything. Microsoft's all about choice. And sometimes that can be a little frustrating because you can be 50,000 different ways to do the same thing. I'm pretty sure there's more than one way to do mail merge these days, for instance. And we're continuing down that path as well. So when it comes to deploying applications, you know, we can still deploy them directly from the online source, being the business store or the application store or the company portal that's being provided to us via Intune or System Center. But we can also take these applications and still put them in an image. You know, we're not going to say, right, the days of the image is over. In fact, the days of the image are still very much alive. And in the next few minutes, we'll talk a bit more about that. And we'll also support any style of organization that you want. Simply by, if we're a very small environment, we might choose to just procure those applications and put them in an image. In a larger environment, we might decide to feed those through the business store or feed them through Microsoft Intune. In a much larger environment where we have a mixture of BYOD devices and education institution owned devices, we might be using something like ConfigMan to push out to the owned devices and Intune to push out to the BYOD devices. When it comes to safety and security, a lot of stuff that we've done there. And remember what Brett Anderson was talking about this morning. It's all about having an absolutely rock-solid identity foundation. And what did we do in Windows 8 to you that you weren't particularly impressed with? Sorry?
Split the identities.
We split the identities. We said, righto, we've got the local identity and we've got this damn Microsoft account that we want you to put on there to be able to do anything useful. And that really didn't go down too well. So we knew we needed to get away from that. In this version of Windows, what we're allowing you to do now is identify yourself using your Office 365 credentials, which are, of course, your Azure Active Directory credentials. But we're not going to stop you from using any other standard identity that you want. So you may choose to standardize on an Azure Active Directory identity. You may choose to standardize on an Active Directory identity. If you still want to use Microsoft accounts in your environment, you can do that. And, of course, local accounts on local machines are available too. What we expect to see moving forward is a lot more people using Azure Active Directory Join as a way of providing not just that single sign-on capability for all of the SaaS applications that you use on a day-to-day basis and all of the websites that you use on a day-to-day basis, but also provide us the ability to start thinking about doing password changes through the cloud and having those write back to the local Active Directory through password write back as part of our Azure Active Directory Premium service. If we can get to that point where the identity is secure, then we're in a pretty good place straight away. As I said before, I already talked about Azure Active Directory as a way of providing identity to Windows. This is now part of the base operating system. When we build out a Windows 10 device and we go through the UBI experience, the out-of-box experience, the first time it starts up, we will actually ask the student whether or not they are joining a domain or whether or not they're joining an organisation. And when we choose to join an organisation, what we'll do is we'll pop up the Azure Active Directory login screen. We can then get the student to put in their Office 365 credentials. We can then log into Azure Active Directory, which effectively joins the machine to Azure Active Directory, and then optionally goes off to a light management service such as Microsoft Intune, enrolls that machine into Microsoft Intune, and then start configuring the machine the way it needs to be on the network. Who has issues with students bringing in machines and having to get them on the Wi-Fi and provision the certificates down to the machines and blah, 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 before they can do anything useful? Wouldn't it be nice if we could provide as an information pack to students just the ability to say, right, go into your settings, go into Work Access, tell it to join an Azure Active Directory, put in your school credentials, and then what will happen is, over the course of the holidays, it will connect into your management environment, it'll pull down the apps that are needed to the machine, it'll provision the certificates that are needed to the machine, it'll set up all the Wi-Fi profiles that are needed for the machine. So the day one, when they step into the school environment or the university environment onto campus, the thing is already ready to go. Would that not be nice? We can effectively do this with Windows 10, Azure Active Directory, and Microsoft Intune. The challenge you're going to have here, however, is getting them to read the damn information in the first place and actually perform the steps that are needed in order to get this done. So who's in a K-12 primary school to high school environment? Yep. So what do? Right, you've got all this set up. It is fantastic. All we've got to do is just put that information in, done. So what are we going to do? At the end of the year, we're going to send out that notice to all those parents to say, do this on your kid's machine. And if you're really lucky, 5% of them might even open the email. And when 5% of them open that email, maybe 10% of the 5% that open the email will actually perform the task on the machine. But unfortunately, that's a human problem and not a problem with the technology. But at least if we can get to a point where when we step on site, we're ready to go, that's going to solve us a hell of a lot of problems a little bit further down the track. One of the other things that we've done a lot of work on is Microsoft Passport being a new strong identity option that utilizes TPM 2.0 to securely store credentials on a machine. Microsoft Passport works hand in hand with Windows Hello. And Windows Hello is a new biometric mechanism that we can use to identify ourselves to Windows to ensure that we are who we say we are. Why are we doing this? Because we want to get away from passwords, because passwords are easy to crack. We heard that this morning in Brad's talk. With Windows Hello, we can use maybe a fingerprint scanner or a RealSense style camera to look at the person's face, identify who they are, and log them on using the credentials that are stored inside Microsoft Passport. We might get to a point where we're storing a PIN inside Microsoft Passport rather than a password, which is in itself more secure than a password. And a lot of people, when they're hearing about Windows Hello, say, all right, so hang on a minute, what you're going to do is you're going to scan someone's face and you're going to look at that and you're going to let us in. Everyone says, that's not going to work. That's going to be rubbish. All we'll do is the school bully will grab the kid, throw the head down onto the photocopier, take a scan of the face on the photocopier, and then hold it up against the Windows Hello camera. Now, the good thing about the Windows Hello camera is that it uses infrared technology. So if I just stick up a piece of paper doesn't give off much heat, unless, of course, I'm holding a cigarette lighter behind it. But what's most likely going to happen there is the paper is going to catch on fire, and it's not going to look much like the kid anymore. Won't take long at all. So with this infrared technology, we can get an understanding of whether a real person is standing in front of us or whether it's a fake person. But you're still not happy. You're going, no, you'll get it wrong. It's facial recognition. It's heat sensing. It gets it wrong once every about 120,000 times. And you go, well, that's no good, because what happens on the 120,001st time the kid tries to log on? I said, well, the kid's been at your school for a long time, most likely. There's something wrong with this kid that we need to perhaps send them elsewhere to get educated. Because you know, Patricia, they're probably in their 70s by now. So, but that's all right. If you need greater level of granularity, you can set Windows Hello to force the person to move their head from side to side, taking that failure rate from about 1 in 120,000 to 1 in a million. If they're still there at that millionth time, you're probably not there anymore, so you don't care. So it's a really interesting piece of technology, and a lot of the new devices coming out have got Windows Hello capable hardware inside them. If you look at the new Surface range, Surface Pro 4, Surface Book, they all have cameras inside them that are Windows Hello capable. So this is definitely something you want to take a look at when you go down to the showcase area a little bit later on, see if you can get someone to do a Windows Hello demo for you. If Jeff Alexander's there, he loves that type of stuff, he'll show it to you. Other things we need to think about: anywhere and anytime remote access. So who uses direct access today as a means of providing beautiful VPN clientless connectivity into the organisation? You've got to love that, right? Because what happens to any user that is faced with the concept of a VPN client? what happens? They turn into an infant immediately. I cannot possibly do this. Right? The concept of double-clicking a VPN client, potentially authenticating to that VPN client, and maybe pressing a button on a token to get a number becomes incredibly difficult to do. And if they can manage to do that, then what do they do to their token? They leave it in their pocket, they wash their pants, the token's ruined. So you go through tons and tons and tons of tokens. You know, the VPN client is a horrible experience. So what we have is a number of capabilities in the operating system. Direct access, still there, fantastic, a lot easier to do now on the server side than it used to be in previous editions of Windows. But we also now have that concept of application VPN, which has been there always in Windows 8. So with Windows 8, we had the application-specific VPN. So if we fired up an app and it needed a VPN, we could force the VPN client to connect and get that done. But now what we have is the ability not only for an application to sense when it needs to execute the VPN, but with Windows 10, we are intelligent enough to say when that VPN goes up for this application, any traffic for that application goes down the VPN, any other traffic goes straight out the internet connection of the machine, similar to what we do in direct access. We can even do forced tunneling if we need to get everything down that VPN once it's established. So lots of stuff in here to make it easier in general to get connected and also keep us secure. When it comes to deploying and managing the operating system, got 20 minutes left. There's a beer coming. Not in this room, but it's coming. This is the thing we're all generally most worried about. As I've said many times in a lot of my presentations, and I haven't said it here yet, this is the last big deployment of Windows that we're ever going to do. There's not going to be another major version of Windows. I'm being recorded, so I'm not going to do the joke that I usually do that goes with it, but if you want to hear it, you can come and see me later on when I'm not being recorded. Is this the end of wipe and load? No, it's not. Can be if you want it to be, but it doesn't have to be. People are worried that by moving to Windows 10, we are going to force you down a certain way of deploying that operating system. If today you, generally speaking, do a massive monolithic image and you want to keep it that way and always wipe and load your machines whenever you need to do it, knock yourself out. We're going to let you keep doing that. But these days, we have the concept of the managed in-place upgrade. And you know, in years past, we've said to you, just do an in-place upgrade, mate. She'll be right. And you went, yeah, I believe you. You'd never lie to me. You're a big software company. You'd never get anything wrong when you said that. So I'm going to do that in-place upgrade. I feel lucky today. I've got NT351. It's running beautifully. I'm going to in-place upgrade it to NT4. And how did that go for you? It didn't go terribly well, did it? But you went, nah, it's all right, because I trust you. Next time, you know, Windows 2000, beauty, it's going to work. And you did that in-place upgrade to Windows 2000. What happened? And that leads to that behavior of, oh, you've released a new operating system. I'll just wait for Service Pack 1. We ain't got no Service Pack 1 anymore. We've just got these regular updates that are coming down the pipe. So we did a lot of work to make sure that a managed in-place upgrade would work properly. I've done around about 60 upgrades and builds of Windows, and I've had a couple of failures, but at the end of the day, it is a very reliable system. I won't say it's going to be 100% reliable, because nothing is ever going to be 100% reliable in IT, but it is pretty damn solid. If you want to do an in-place upgrade on a machine, not a problem. You execute that either through something like Configuration Manager, or of course manually if the end user is just firing it off themselves. What we'll do is we'll take an inventory of the machine, we'll find all of their apps, all of their data, all of their settings, we'll hive that off, we'll do a compatibility check of all of the applications and all of the drivers specifically, and if we see anything that says, nah, that upgrade ain't going to work, then we will stop the upgrade from happening. We'll just bail on you straight away. If everything's good, what we'll do is we will reboot the machine, we'll go into the Windows RE, Windows Recovery Environment mode. And what we will do is we will simply rename the Windows directory to windows.old, and we will stick a bog standard install.wim of Windows 10 where the original Windows was. Notice I say a bog standard install.wim. In-place upgrades do not work with a custom WIM. If you're going down the custom WIM path, you are still doing a wipe and load. Once we've done that, we'll reboot again. We'll basically restore all the symbolic links to the applications and settings. We'll rebuild the registry the way it needs to be. We'll reboot one more time. We'll go into a quick UBI experience, which could all be automated through Config Manager, and then the user is logging in to a beautiful, excellent, happily upgraded machine, unless, of course, you get the error that says something happened. Runtime configuration. This is gold, and I'll leave that for a couple more slides because I want to talk a bit more about that. But ultimately, by giving you choice in how we do deployment, we're hoping that we can reduce the costs that have traditionally been associated with that. So when we think about our deployment choices, Wipe and load. Go there if you need to. Not a problem. We're not going to drop support for that. In-place upgrade. If you're Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1, this is the best way for you to go if you're not doing major changes to the machine. I mean, obviously, if I'm going from 32 to 64-bit, I can't in-place upgrade that. Obviously, if I'm going to change the layout of the partitions on the disk, I can't do an in-place upgrade because I'm essentially blowing everything away, et cetera, et cetera. So look at the different scenarios that you're facing and decide where a wipe and load is a necessity, where an in-place upgrade is a possibility. And then the last one is provisioning. Provisioning is a way for us to now essentially take a machine off the shelf from the OEM, run a simple package against that, which will configure the machine the way we need it on our network. Might make a product key change to bring it from, let's say, Windows 10 Home or Pro to Windows 10 Education. Might put some applications on it. If you know the uninstall routines for an application, might remove some vendor stuff that's on there that you don't want, some, you know, OEM basic stuff that you don't need on there, and set down your certificates, set down your Wi-Fi profiles, just get the machine ready to go. That package can be consumed via a USB stick. That package could be put on a network share. That package could even be emailed to someone to execute against the machine to get it configured the way you want it. We call it a provisioning package. Now, if you're interested in knowing more about this, then come to our Twilight session tomorrow. Myself and Jeff Alexander are running a session on provisioning packages in Windows 10. We'll show you exactly how this can work. This can be done on a full-blown Windows 10 tablet, desktop, can even be done on a phone device. The idea behind it is, I want to take essentially an XML representation of what I want the machine to look like when I'm finished, dump that down using Open Mobile Device Management Alliance commands, and then get that up and running. You can even kinda, sorta, maybe do a try-hard version of steady state with it. By sticking this provisioning package in an image, every time the machine reboots, it will reapply the provisioning package. So if the user has, you know, removed some certificates, deleted some Wi-Fi settings, et cetera, when they've been using the machine, when it reboots, it'll reapply those. But please don't think of it as a complete replacement for something like a steady state, but it gives you some capability of maintaining settings and values when the machine's rebooted. We believe that moving in place is the best way for you to go for your enterprise, right? It's generally the preferred option for education. I've talked about how this works already. Please, 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 if you're interested in knowing more about how to do the in-place upgrade and even how to do a full wipe and load, go to the hands-on lab area, because at the hands-on lab area, we have three different labs that we can use for training ourselves with deployment in Windows 10. The first one is working with task sequences, which are a mainstay of the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and System Center Configuration Manager. We have a lab that deploys Windows 10 to a device using MDT on its own as a free way of doing things. And we also have a lab that uses System Center Configuration Manager 2012 R2 to deploy a Windows 10 image to a machine. Check them out. If you don't know how to do it, go do the hands-on labs. If you're not happy sitting there with the hands-on labs on your own, they're even running them as instructor-led labs later in the week. So check that out. Wayne McGlynn will be running those from Dimension Data Learning Solutions, and he knows his stuff backwards when it comes to this. So really worth looking at. So just to give you an idea of what the whole scenario looks like in an in-place upgrade, and we're just going to do it with a few screenshots. So what you can see here is an example of my machine running my current version of the operating system, in this case being Windows 7. So what I'm going to do is an in-place upgrade of this machine. And the challenge of the in-place upgrade, of course, or the challenge of moving a user from one version of the operating system to another, is that when you do a wipe and load, you want to make sure that that environment looks the same to the end user when they log on as it did when they started. Because as we all know, the sky is going to fall if the picture of the dog is not on the wallpaper after we've moved from Windows 7 to Windows 10. The user is going to be incapable of doing anything. And God forbid that if the user, like everybody, puts their entire life on the desktop. We've all seen that before, right? The entire life's on the desktop. If that life is not still there when they log back in, they are going to be sitting in the corner and rocking back and forth and dribbling, and is not going to be a pretty sight. So we want to make sure this works. I remember when I was working at a university in Victoria a long, long time ago, and this is a long, long, long time ago, we had this one PhD student that put a copy of their thesis on the desktop of a machine. You know where this is going already. The only copy they owned, early 90s, only copy they owned. What did we do to back up desktops? Nothing. What happened to the desktop? It blew up. Lost their thesis. What's that got to do with re-imaging, Andrew? Nothing at all. I just thought I'd mention it. But Maybe you should also check out the backup sessions that are coming out later this week. In any case, what we've got here is our Windows 7 environment, and what we're going to do is we're going to execute the in-place upgrade against it through Configuration Manager. So what happens is Configuration Manager starts the in-place upgrade. So we go through our pre-setup steps. Starts the upgrade windows, brings down the WIM, pre-stages it onto the machine. We reboot. We basically, as I said before, take Windows, rename it to Windows.old, put the install.wim down. And then after we've restored all of our symbolic links and rebuilt our registry, we reboot and we see ourselves in our brand new version of Windows 10 with everything left the way it was. So everything is protected. The user continues to work. The only difference now is their start screen is a little groovier. One of the things I might point out about the start screen too, and I've got around about 10 minutes left, is you know how I talked about those live tiles before and how useful live tiles can be for just that general dynamic updating of information that's being shown to the user. One of the great things you'll get in Windows 10 Enterprise and Windows 10 Education is the ability for us to control that start screen layout and control via group policy whether live tiles are turned on. Live tiles are great, but they're not always great. And one of the things that I've fallen afoul of is particularly the news app. So who's ever been presenting to a bunch of people and the news live tile has popped something up that you'd rather wish it didn't? Yeah, me, many times. That's almost as bad as the time I almost presented to a religious organisation on my laptop with my World of Warcraft wallpaper on, which basically, if you play World of Warcraft, yes, if you're a sad loser like me, and if you play World of Warcraft, you may be familiar with a character called Illidan Stormrage, who is a demon, and that was on my wallpaper when I went to project to the educational to the religious institution. Do you think I was allowed back? Do you think they saw the funny side? No, they didn't. So these are things we worry about, but live tiles particularly so. Turn them off for certain apps if you don't need them, because the last thing you want is something inappropriate showing up, especially in a lower grade classroom environment, simply because of the news tile. You know, it very quickly becomes your fault, and that can lead you into all sorts of problems. So let's just very quickly show you what provisioning is all about. And I don't intend to go through this in any great detail. We're not going to show you a demo on this one because that's the entire guts of the session tomorrow. But basically, as I said before, the idea of provisioning packages is that we take a piece of hardware off the shelf, we apply a provisioning package to that machine, whether it be on a USB stick, NFC type tag, or even just being invoked directly from an email or a network share. And that provisioning package will basically configure the device to be ready for productive use. Change the product key, set up the certificates, set up the Wi-Fi profiles. How does it actually work? Well, what we do is we use a new tool called the Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer, which is a tool that replaces the traditional System Image Manager tool. Does everything that System Image Manager did, but also allows you to create provisioning packages. And because it's called the Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer, it has the very cool name of Wicked associated with it. So what you do is you get the Wicked tool and you use the Wicked tool to build a provisioning package. The provisioning package comes out as a PPKG file and some associated assets that go with it. What we then do is we get the end user to execute the PPKG file, which configures the machine the way it needs to be configured. The PPKG file can be encrypted with a password, and it can be signed as well to ensure that the proper user is using it, who knows the password, and the thing is digitally signed so we know it's not dodgy. And what that will do is configure the machine the way it should be, reboot the machine, sometimes twice, and then the machine is ready to go. What does it actually look like very quickly? There it goes, I think. There we go. Right, so the video's going. So what happens is we execute the PPKG, we say yes. It says, you sure you want to do this? We haven't even bothered to put a password or sign this one. We go, yeah, why not? We're feeling lucky. Notice it says Windows 10 Pro, technical preview here, because this one is going to change the product key to Windows 10 Enterprise or Windows 10 Education. One of the great things about Home or Pro these days is that you can simply add a new product key to an existing installation of Windows and change it into the version that you need, very similar to what we used to do with any time upgrade. So you don't necessarily have to do a re-image of a machine to get where you need. I would have thought that when we built this video, we wouldn't have made you sit there looking at a percentage thing going up and down, but I figured we're all probably fairly comfortable with seeing stuff like this, so we'd enjoy it anyway. How much of your life have you spent looking at a blue bar moving from that side of the screen to the other? Or I should do from there to there for everyone in the audience. It's going to be pretty bad. We've rebooted. Oh, yeah. Hi. We're just setting everything up for you.
This won't take very long.
This won't take very long. These aren't the droids you're looking for. And you're sitting there feeling fantastic. And you'll notice now we've gone to Windows 10 Enterprise. Yes, no one believes me because it was a video, but you can see it tomorrow for real if you come to the session. Who's coming to the session? Oh, good on you. Now, because it's at 6:30, we may even have some beers on stage. Who knows? So you know, we'll see how we can go. Hey?
What about the crowd?
Well, it's not just for me, man. Like, if they're up there, anyone can take them. We'll see how we go. All righty. So the key here is you're provisioning the machine. You're not re-imaging the machine, which means you're not touching that. You're only touching that very lightly. You're not doing a complete rebuild. And, of course, one of the benefits here is if this is a BYOD device, you didn't just re-image it with your own image, blowing away their recovery partition and making it very hard for them to get back to where they need to be when they leave the school or the university. How often have you gone, right, kid has brought in laptop that has been bought by parents. We need to get it onto the school's environment. I know what I'll do. I'll re-image it. Who's done that? Who's done that? Come on, I know at least one of you has done it. Who just doesn't want to put their hand up? Who just wants to go and have a beer? Sweet, I thought I'd get something out of that. Right. So the thing here is that as soon as you decide to re-image that kid's laptop with your environment, you have removed that recovery partition, which means you now become personally responsible for anything that happens to that machine when they leave. Similar to when you go and fix your mate's machine. You know how you go and fix your mate's machine or your family's machine, and anything that happens to it from that point on is your fault. Right? Yeah, I fixed it. I put the start menu back where it should be, Dad, because you moved it over there and don't know how to move it back again. And now you've spilt coffee all over the keyboard. Yeah, that is my fault, absolutely, because I touched your machine. The same happens at the school, because what happens is the kid leaves the school, parent says, I want to put back to factory ship, thanks. And you went, oh, I just blew away the recovery partition. No problem. We'll pause the recording at this point. Thank you. And what do you do now? You go, right, better get on the torrent sites and see if I can find the recovery disk. Recovery disk for that ancient bloody model recording on. And then when you get it, you can put the thing back to factory ship because that's now your problem. Right? And I have that, and that you're laughing because you've done it right. That definitely happens. If we can just provision the machine to just give itself the settings that it needs to be on your environment, you don't harm that recovery partition, which means at the end of the day, if they leave, they can just reset it back to factory shipped. They're all good to go. So you've got to love that. Now, we talked about traditional deployment. I have 2 minutes left. I've sort of covered this already. At the end of the day, what we're doing is we're enhancing the existing tools without making things change in a major way. If you're used to doing things the way you do with Config Manager today or MDT today, very few changes to deal with. If you want to use provisioning packages, slight change, but not overly difficult by any stretch of the imagination. Alrighty. So, the last thing I want to leave you with is this happy child staring up into the sky. And the reason this child is happy and staring into the sky is because they're using Windows 10 and their life's a hell of a lot easier. And it's made your life a hell of a lot easier as well, is the way you've gone. Last thing I want to leave with you. We've done quite a good job of confusing what on earth Windows 10 education is. Hands up in the room right now if you have a good understanding of the Windows 10 education SKU and what it gives you that is different from all the other SKUs. One hand goes up. Right. And the reason being is because we said, yeah, it's all these fantastic education-specific features. No. This Windows 10 education is simply a version of Windows 10 that has the exact same feature set as Windows 10 Enterprise. But we can get to Windows 10 education by changing the product key on a Windows 10 Home or a Windows 10 Pro machine, which means when your student brings their BYOD device in running Windows 10 Home or Windows 10 Pro, all you do is change the product key, opens the Enterprise feature set, you can use it the way you'd use anything else in your environment. That's it. But you haven't had to re-image it. Maybe you'll provision it, maybe you'll join it to Microsoft Intune to configure it the way you need it, but fundamentally, that machine is now an education machine and opening it up for all the enterprise features. Does that mean that I now need to run Windows 10 Education as my SOE for all those machines I fully manage? No. You can keep running Windows 10 Enterprise if you want. But thinking of education is a really good thing for those kids bringing in those BYOD devices that are running Home or Pro that don't have the functionality that you would normally rely on in Enterprise. That key change that non-destructive key change will get them where they need to be. All right, that's it. We are exactly on time. So now if we sprint, because we're in the furthest part of the building from the showcase, we can get the beer before everybody else does. Please, everybody, if you've enjoyed this session, give us an evaluation. I don't know what the daily prizes are, but I'm sure they're awesome. And hopefully see you tomorrow for the provisioning session. If you've got any questions, feel free to come up and have a chat to us. Thanks a lot.